Good morning. It is February 1st. We're going to call it spring and we are saying goodbye to a particularly long January. And for many, it won't be forgotten. No water, no electricity, no phone, no Wi-Fi. For hundreds of thousands of people, the aftermath of Storm Éowyn was almost as bad as the storm itself. And for a whole host of people, it's not over yet. And it's been a horrible week. On Tuesday, Claire spoke to Dr. Peter Sloan. He runs a single GP practice in Connemara.
I happened to get one call from somebody just at the tail end of the red, so I'm not suggesting that going out in a red warning is a good idea, but right at the tail end of a red from a local family whose child was having a full-blown seizure. And I just said, right, text me your code, which they couldn't. I got into my car, I drove 50 yards one way, a big tree down, 100 yards the other way, and a big tree down. And so I basically climbed out through a tree and somebody took me to the child, who is fortunately okay. A lot of these things, Claire, I think, emphasise the fact that if you talk to people in Connemara, talk to people in the locality here, we often feel that as citizens of the state that we live in, that we are valued less. The notion of rural general practice, critical infrastructure. Like we had a little bit of snow about 4 weeks ago, and we had no water and no power and no phone for 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So this event, it's predictable. These things are predictable, and we don't really plan particularly well for them.
And on Wednesday's News at One, another doctor, this time Catherine Sweeney, whose practice is in Dunmore in County Galway.
We have a situation where we have no electricity, we have no broadband, and we have a boil water notice. So we have to remain closed. We are currently operating out of the kitchen of my home in Claremorris, which is 25 minutes away. We are providing services that include childhood vaccines, acute illness, palliative care. And we are now in a situation where all our vaccines have they will have to be disposed of. So childhood vaccines will have to be deferred, delayed. We have no idea when we will get the next stock in. We have to wait until our electricity is back. So it's a very difficult situation to find yourself in. And there's no, we are left to fend for ourselves. And it's not just me. It's not just, you know, it's not just the medical practice. We have the pharmacy across the road. Yesterday, I was dropping in prescriptions for patients by hand, and they were working in candlelight.
And most of the households who are suffering are on the Western Seaboard. Dublin has mostly been unaffected. So is there a disconnect between the capital and the rest of the country?
Listening to you, it's clear that you're getting very frustrated and indeed concerned about the situation. Do you have a sense that people in Dublin aren't quite getting this because in the main our lives are as normal?
Well, I am from Dublin myself. I'm from Glasnevin in Dublin. I happened to have an appointment in Dublin on Monday, and I was in my home place in Dublin on Monday, and it is very much business as usual in Dublin. There doesn't seem to have any. It does not impact on the people in the East Coast to the same extent that it does in the West. That's not the fault of the people on the East Coast or in Dublin. But when you travel out of Dublin and you head into the dark, and I mean coming in through towns in the west of Ireland on my way home on Monday, that were in darkness. There is no light. It is a contrast between literally night and day. So there is a sense of us being forgotten, and we have been left to our own devices.
So without light, heat and sometimes water, it was a hellishly long week for many. And no phone communication added massively to the stress and the worry. For Liveline, Katie spoke to those who called in or could get through.
I know 5 days seems like nothing, but when you're living in cold and damp and you notice like they're not sick, but their noses are running. When you bring them from cold into heat, their little faces are getting flushed because the blood is circulating again in their bodies. It's very difficult.
I'm in Mayo, in County Mayo. To me, I'm a carer for an elderly parent. Being without water is the worst thing. There's the whole issue of not being able to flush toilets, not being able to wash hands. Now, my mother is in her 90s with bowel issues, and it's just been a disaster the last few days for her, getting up several times a night and trying to get water in buckets outside to see can you flush the toilet every now and then. It's just, it's a big issue. And I suppose
how's your freezer pad?
Everything's gone, you know. So now, myself and my partner, we hadn't done our shopping prior, but my parents had. And they have a full freezer of food. Now, fair enough, it's probably only a week and a half, 2 weeks of food, but that's gone in the bin now. Do you know what I mean? And it's all financial losses to them, and there's no answers. I was actually speaking to one office yesterday that told me to print out the farm and bring it into the office, and I'm like, but we've no power. How do you
where
do
Where are you
these
going
things,
to get a printer, you know? From? Where are you based, Catherine?
Tyrone, County Galway.
And how are you?
Not good. Not good. We're so cold. We're hungry. We're exhausted. Trying to get heat, calling to older people. I'm 65 and I'm trying to look after 75 and 80-year-old people, about six of them. And they're way colder than I am. We're just frozen. We're so exhausted. We're so hungry. We didn't have a hot meal since last Wednesday, just before the storm. And the government aren't doing anything for us. It's a disgrace.
We're actually based in Dublin, between Swords and Ashburn. It's just living in an ice box. We have an open fire and we have a gas hob with two rings for cooking, but that's all. And my daughter has a medical condition and we had to move out. Two nights we stayed in a hotel.
I work for a Carlow company and I do most of my work in Dublin here. So I left Connemara at 3 o'clock this morning, drove up here. But I'm returning this evening because I have no way of making contact with my family. Some of my slates have left the roof of the house. There's another storm coming in on Wednesday. The torrential rain that I had coming up the way this morning, I didn't know if there had water gone through the filter line.
We have been without power since 3:40 on Friday morning. I live with my brother there in the house. He's on a breeding machine at night, so the machine is connected to the power all night long. Like, so since then, we've been checked into hotels. Every day, we're booking day by day, packing your stuff up, leaving, hoping that we're going home. And then when it comes to that even, you're not going home.
So you're down in Clare?
Yeah, West Clare, Kilmahill. From our point of view, it's the hope that has been kind of killing us. You know, we're seeing everyone else around us get up. And with power and water, and that's just kind of where we are at now, you know.
It is. It's the hope that kills you, for sure.
Our government are not proactive; they're reactive. They knew this was coming. There was hurricane chasers in Shannon on Thursday, getting ready to go out to the storm because they were classing it as one of the largest coming towards Ireland. Why was our government not going? Let's get an action plan in place. Let's get people in. We're going to need more people.
Just some of the voices on this week's Live Line, and initial resilience turning to anger. Sinn Féin called on the government to reconvene the Dáil, leading to counter-accusations of the opposition politicising the storm damage. Well, on Morning Ireland on Tuesday, Fianna Fáil TD for Mayo and Minister for Social Protection, Rural and Community Development and the Gaeltacht, Dara Cailleary, joined Audrey.
This is a question about resources. It's a question about investment in infrastructure, investment in people and personnel who can respond to getting power back, who can be better prepared to get power back when we have weather events of this nature.
Look, we're working, as I said, and we took this most severe storm we've had in many decades. We are investing in the grid through AirGrid. So, for instance, we have a major investment underway here in the West and the Northwest at the moment, and Crest investing in the strengthening of the grid. Mm. But our major priority, Audrey, is to get that connection restored, to ensure that we have supports available. Local authorities are stepping up our humanitarian centres right across the country.
But there aren't enough repair crews in place. You need help from outside the country. Hubs are only opening today, 4 days later. Generators
opened over the weekend, actually, Audrey.
Okay, well, generators, why aren't they already in place rather than being brought in days later?
We have quite a number of generators in place. And I think if you heard from Margaret Atwood earlier, she spoke about how Irish Water are moving generators around where they need them. You also heard from the telecom companies. They have generators. I am working to try and get generators for the agricultural community. On Saturday morning, we worked hard to get generators out to the islands so that we would have power on the islands. So we've been working through this right through the weekend on this Audrey, you know, we will learn lessons. Absolutely. Absolutely, we're going to reflect on this, reflect on the severity of both this storm and the previous storm, and make changes as is necessary. But our immediate response over since Friday and right through today and tomorrow will be getting responses up, getting repairs done, getting the humanitarian hubs up, and also the humanitarian assistance scheme. I just re-emphasise that is available from the Department of Social Protection. It is two tranches. It has an immediate emergency support, which is not income tested. That's based on immediate needs. And then there's the infrastructural support for rebuilding of damaged houses or damage of white goods. That is means tested, but we, as I said, will be flexible. Okay.
Minister Derek Leary on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. And as crews work around the clock to get power and water back, there are still thousands of homes waiting.
Thank you to our listeners in Longford, in Westmeath, in Roscommon and in Cavan who have been in touch this morning. Let me bring you some of their messages. So Eileen says, it's my eighth day without electricity or internet. I'm living in Kilbeggan in County Westmeath. I got notifications on two occasions that the power would be restored, but it hasn't happened yet. Another, we're beside Lochkey in North Roscommon. We're on day eight without electricity, but we're lucky enough. We have an open fire, a gas stove, a barbecue on which we're cooking and boiling our water for tea and coffee and washing up. The local GAA centre for showers, phone charging, etc. The estimate from PowerCheck for restoration is the 5th of February. Another one, day 9 of no power in Arva in County Cavan. I'm totally fed up at this stage. This would not be tolerated had it happened in the Greater Dublin area. It's an absolute disgrace. And a listener in Esker in Longford, still no water after 7 days. The electricity only came back one day ago. And the WhatsApp.
What a week. Back in a bit. Welcome back. It's Bridget's day and she is associated with this.
Imbolg.
Thank you, Sean, putting the spring in our sandal. And he was joined by Dr. Mary Condren, author of The Serpent and the Goddess, Women, Religion and Power in Celtic Ireland.
For those who haven't heard the term before, although it's become much more popular in recent times, Mary Condren.
Imbolg means in the belly. And that's one of the interpretations. But all of the rituals and the material artefacts, the ritual artefacts around Imbolg have to do with regeneration. They have to do with birth. They have to do with regenerating what is already there. And they have to do with nurture. So it's fertility, but not simply it's not simply about nature. It's also about what we need to do to ourselves to be in alignment with our bodies, with our communities and with the universe.
And Imbolg is, long before Christianity, is associated with the name Bridget, I think, isn't it?
Certainly, since the advent of Christianity, Bridget has been associated with it. Now, it's typical of Christian traditions to take over at the old festivals. In fact, Pope Gelasius made a point of saying, you know, take over the old festivals because that's the only way that you can, you know, get established in new countries. And for that reason, they took over Christmas, they took over Easter, and all of them, of course, were the natural turnings of the year.
Oh, interesting stuff. And then on Rising Time, a bit of a slagging for our Sinead Neulahan.
The latest traffic and travel news.
Are you off for La Llobregat?
I am, yeah. I love La Llobregat. It's lovely, isn't it? There's something about it. It's the start of spring. And I used to go around to the houses with dolls when I was younger, if I remember correctly. That was a tradition that we had in West Kerry. Yeah,
you'd
bring your little dolls around to the neighbours to show them the little your collection.
Des used to do that as well.
Here's your one with the dolls again.
And when I say dolls, I probably had about 5 Barbies.
Mammy, Sinead is at the door from next. Sinead from up the road is at the door with the dollies.
Somebody go to her.
Lock the door fast. Turn off the lights, we're not in.
You know, in Glass Tool, there used to be a fella going around with action men.
Dez Cahan's at the door with the action men.
My shirt off.
Just at the spar
Stand
shop there.
In a Jeep.
Oh, just beside Quint there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Sinead.
Okay, have a lovely good, day. So
what, and what time were you started the tour with the dollies?
8 a.m. we'll say.
Are you doing that in Stony Bath or are you?
Yeah.
What did you make them? What did you make them out of, Sinead?
No, like I'd have my dolls, my collection of dolls.
Oh, the actual dolls.
The actual dolls, yeah.
And would there be other people on the doll tour with you?
Sometimes my sisters would have joined me.
Yeah.
But they bring their
dogs. Somebody go and look after her.
Go around to the neighbours.
Stand down, Action Men, because she's actually keeping up a long tradition of biddies and bwee jokes, albeit with a hot pink Barbie twist. Now, just imagine how flattering and exciting it would be if a celebrity, a proper celeb, took a shine to you. Wow. And when they asked you for a bit of money just to tide them over well, you might be surprised at how quickly you could end up falling for it. On Thursday's Drive Time, Barry Lenihan spoke to a Dublin woman they called Sinead, and she had struck up a relationship with Coldplay frontman Chris Martin, except it was not the real Chris Martin. They were scammers. It had all started during COVID.
In early 2021, what happened was I responded to a post that Coldplay management put up on Coldplay's Twitter. I got a contact from a man purporting to be Chris Martin. He sent me a message via Twitter with images of Chris Martin and Chris Martin's name on the account. And then he asked me for my phone number, and I was quite dazzled. I didn't believe it was true initially, but then I was like, could it be? And I gave my number, and he contacted me via WhatsApp and Facebook with fake Chris Martin accounts as well. And then he contacted me in Skype.
From an initial engagement to the band's official Twitter account, you were targeted from there.
I think I gave one word reply to a post that they put up, and he contacted me from that. So they're obviously trawling readers' comments and targeting people that way. He contacted me on Facebook, and he had a moniker under Chris Martin's name. And he was like, keep this to ourselves. You know, I can't really go public because I'm a big name star, like, obviously. So I just want to, I don't want you to talk to anyone about me talking to you. I want you to keep it secret. And then he moved it into Skype, and he was manipulating me, and kind of he started grooming me a bit more and more.
He built up trust with you, didn't
he? He built up trust, and he was very smooth. He'd be humorous in his conversation. He'd be kind with his words towards me. But he did say initially, don't tell anyone that you're talking to me.
And what had started in friendship quickly became romantic. Now, these scammers are good at what they do, and with AI, only getting better.
I said to him at one point, you have a girlfriend? And he was like, no, that's fake. It's all for showbiz. It's put on.
Talk to me about the Skype, and in particular the phone calls. What were they like?
He started sending me images of the real Chris Martin, but they were like direct headshots of him looking at the camera. Images of orphans that he said he was looking after. He sent me a passport for Chris Martin, which was, when you look closely at it, it was a German background, but it had all Chris Martin's information on the passport. He sent me a driver's license for Chris Martin. I got a phone call off him. In the video, there was Phil Harvey, who's his manager, Guy Berryman, who's another member of the band.
And they were talking directly to you?
They were talking to me, yeah. The video was playing in Skype, and they were talking to me. Now, it was muffled, but it was enough to deceive me.
The fake Chris Martin waved at you in one communications as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was every day for 4 months until...
Oh, it was constant. He would contact me from 7 in the morning until 12 o'clock at night, all day long, talking and messaging me and being romantic. And I thought it was the real person that I thought I was talking to, Chris Martin.
The scammers then asked for money for flights and for help with an orphanage the fake Chris Martin was supposedly involved in. Among other excuses, he said his accounts were frozen because of the pandemic. In total, she transferred over €25,000. She eventually told her brother, and it all unravelled.
What went through your mind when the truth became apparent?
I was devastated, really devastated. Like, it was such a large amount of money. Initially, I was like, I was so embarrassed. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I was really depressed. I was like, who am I actually talking to? Like, I've been romantic with this guy, and I've been soft, and I've been kind, and I've been very gentle, and I've been completely manipulated and duped into believing that this person is someone who they are not. Like I said, I felt really stupid. I cried a lot.
You confronted the catfish, didn't you not? And they still persisted with the scam.
Yeah, they said, no, it's Chris Martin, I'm real. It is me and I'm Chris Martin and will you give me another 20,000 euros? And I was like, oh my God, this is unreal. Like, you know, and I was like, no, you're a scammer and I want my money back. And they cut me off then and they stopped all the conversation in Skype.
She reported all of this to the authorities, but they concluded there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute anyone. And as it stands, she's unable to get her money back. She would like tighter codes of conduct in Irish banks to protect customers from catfish scams like these. Barry Lenehan reporting on Drive Time. With Oliver, journalist, critic and writer Fintan O'Toole, and he had praise for decision makers and policy innovators, some of whom include politicians. Because growing up in Crumlin, he was one of five siblings, all very bookish, he said, but that did not always translate into university.
I was the only one who went on to third level education.
Right.
Which was very unusual in working class Dublin.
Oh, really unusual to have one going.
Yeah, you know, even and in fact, as it happened, strangely, after free education was brought in, second level education, the Irish press, they picked a road, a working class road. It happened to be, we had a fairly small road in Crumlin, so they knocked on every door and they said, do you ever think one of your kids would go to university? And it was only one house where somebody said, that happened to me, my dad was home and he said, yeah, I think they might, you know, but nobody else on the road had an idea that this was possible.
Which closes a lot of doors for them in life, didn't it?
It's transformative. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I believe in politics and I believe in the state and all those unfashionable things is, you know, if Donna O'Malley, that great Fianna Fáil Minister for Education, you know, in the 1960s, hadn't really gone on a solo run and announced that they were going to bring in free second level education.
Oh, accidentally, yeah.
I don't think I wouldn't be here talking to you. I wouldn't be the person I am. You know, I wouldn't have had the, you know, great luck that I've had through with this career, you know, because somebody made a decision. And I always remember, like, well, I don't remember live, but I remember seeing his speech that when he announced it, you know, and he said, I'm just ashamed. I'm ashamed of the fact that not only are we making our young people having to emigrate, but they're emigrating without skills. They're emigrating to do the most menial jobs.
Yeah.
And he just had a burning sense of national shame in a way. And at least he thought, well, at least if we have to emigrate, let's go with skills, which of course mostly we do now. You know, it's changed. I mean, God knows I've whined about terrible things in Ireland for long enough, but it is an extraordinary achievement. You know, like, so when I was born, we were the worst educated population in Europe and now we're the best.
Fair point. Fintan O'Toole with Oliver. Now to a complete gear change. The many ways of being in a relationship or relationships. We give you 21st century polyamory. For author of Exciting Times and The Happy Couple, Nisha Dolan, herself in a polyamorous relationship, this was how it worked. For her, at least.
You did say that your relationship map can tend to be at the moment, again, I presume all this is kind of fluid and changes with time and everything. It tends to be women who already have a primary partner, so you'd be the secondary partner. Why do you think that suits you?
Well, first of all, it being women, I think it's very hard to change the script on a man having a second woman, right? There is a very rich history
really,
of that being horrible.
Yeah, okay.
Whereas you can't compare or place in a hierarchy in the same way a relationship with a woman. There isn't a script that says that you're less than whoever the primary partner is just because this person isn't doing certain things with you. And so there's a lot more freedom to just let it mean what you want it to mean. I would say, if the only person you're dating is someone who has a primary partner, that's probably a good way to go insane. But if you yourself have a varied situation going on, I don't see the harm.
All grand, but what about the possessiveness that can be a feature of certain kinds of love, or at least desire?
So people are only human. Is there going to be a little bit of, does jealousy come up in situations?
I think not for me, because I've just got so much else to think about. And both on the level that I don't really structure my life primarily around romantic connections. I would unapologetically put my family and friends above lovers always. And that's one reason I should not be anyone's monogamous partner, right? Because that's the expectation that comes with that. But I think when jealousy does arise, it's worth considering that it's an innate human feeling, but it's also worth considering maybe it's about what you yourself are lacking in the relationship you're directly in. I think often when we resent the time and attention that someone is giving someone else, it's that we feel we're not getting enough from them anyway. And so that will be a problem whether or not we had a scapegoat, as it were.
Oh, terribly wise. Very grown up. Good, clear communication. Boundaries, yeah. All the good stuff. But where does that leave the rest of us? Us dysfunctional souls who might just lose the head.
Is there romance? Because you see, again, my idea of romance is mine is a heteronormative one for me, of one man, one woman. And that's the romantic kind of story, I guess, I've always had in my head. So I think a lot of people might think, but where's the romance if the person you're with is in love with someone else? How can that be a romantic story?
Well, I think the ideal version of anything is romantic. So the ideal version of a monogamous partnership is very romantic. But the idea of someone staying with you because they have to, I find deeply unromantic. And similarly, a cynical version of polyamory, where someone's just like maximising the ego boost that they can get and doesn't hold proper regard for other partners, etc. Deeply unromantic, for sure. But the idea that someone isn't being restricted in any way and is still choosing to spend time with you,
yeah,
and still choosing to have you in their life and to make all the elements work around it, to me, that's deeply romantic.
Okay. And do you fall in love?
I do fall in love very frequently. I'm a complete lover girl.
All right. Okay.
Very interesting. Neisha Dolan with Brendan. Oh, and by the way, her third novel is on the way. Now, the Darcy, for only he would come up with this.
Now, I have a vague memory of talking to a man who ran backwards. I think he might have even ran the whole Dublin City Marathon backwards.
And by the magic of radio, Garrett Darty on the line.
4-time backward running world champion.
Yeah, and all because he likes the sun on his face.
Well, I started doing it in Fairview Park in spring 2009. I turned around to face the sun on my front. It was kind of spiritual. And I noticed the human fascination over it. People were fascinated and people loved it. So I said to myself, I'm just going to keep going. And then I Googled it after 3 or 4 goes of doing it and I discovered there's a world championship coming up in Austria in 2010. And I went there and got a gold medal in my second race.
Right. And was it a sprint? Was it a sprint or middle distance or what was it?
That was 3 kilometres, yes.
Yeah.
But I also did the 10K as well. But they've got every distance at the World Championship from 100 and 200, just like the proper Olympics.
Yeah.
Its official name, retro walking. And when you hear this, well, walking forwards is but a fool's game.
And apart from getting the sun on your face, Garrett.
Yeah.
Did you feel any benefits in those early days of backward running?
Well, different muscles were getting worked out and others were getting rested. My tummy was getting a workout and my back was getting a break.
Yes.
If you go uphill backwards, walking or running, your quads will get worked out straight away. And the calves will get worked out if you walk or run backwards because you're constantly on your toes.
Aha.
So they're not easy muscles to work out.
No.
When you walk back, your shoulders are drawn back. So your chin is up, your chest is out, and your back is straight.
Ah.
And you're landing on your toes. It's almost like how we should walk forward perfectly. It's almost like how a model walks forward.
Yeah. You turn a few heads when you're out and about.
It's contagious. People want to try it, want to do it, want to know all about it.
Yeah.
It increases confidence massively. It makes you confident with your movement. Like, so it's good for old people to prevent them falling over. Most dances, you go forward then you go back.
Yeah.
If we must go forward all the time, then surely to God we got to go backwards some of the time. Just because you can't see behind you doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
And what about the cognitive benefits of it, Garrett?
Cognitive benefit, it engages the right brain. It works on the opposite side of the brain. It grows neural pathways in the brain because you're using brain energy and you're using the whole brain to think about the exercise that you're doing. Your senses get engaged, unlike forward.
Yeah.
You can see two-thirds of what's behind you by looking to the side.
You've really thought about this.
He really has. Sure, it might be the future. Bit in the back. Welcome back. Hugh Weldon is a volunteer on the marine conservation vessel, the Alan Kay, and he wrote First Glimpse of the Antarctic Peninsula for Sunday Miscellany.
Everything is more extreme at sea. Bad days are barely survivable. Gravity becomes a violent, unpredictable force, and you're flung around like a rag doll as the ocean heaves. Corridors warp and twist, hatches snap shut like bear traps. Bad days can become bad weeks, and bad weeks can become bad voyages. Equally, when good things happen, they tend to keep happening. When it comes to the mysterious world of the ocean's depths and the secrets of the frozen far south, there seems no end to the treasures that can be bestowed upon you. Now, off the bow, port side, there's a splash. It's further off this time, maybe a mile range at a bearing of 11 o'clock. Stillness. A humpback whale comes up for air, then dives, showing the intricate beauty of its fluke to the fiery evening sky. The assembly once again becomes unsettled, anxious in anticipation. Then, an eruption. From the depths, the humpback rises with speed, breaking the surface, abandoning the underwater world, and joining life above. For an eternal moment, it hangs in the light, then crashes with a tremendous splash back to the world below. Laughter, joy, hugs. Then someone calls out that the whale has come up for air. Bated breath. Now comes the dive and the whale tail. We count, 20 seconds elapse, and the jester leaps clear into the sky again. Euphoria on the deck of the Alan Kay. Camera shutters click and we celebrate and mourn in equal measure, for such a perfect moment cannot truly be captured, only lived. The humpback breaches a further four times as the Alan Kay sails on to the southwest and into the gathering twilight. I linger on deck, reveling in the atmosphere and wondering what else lies ahead on our voyage.
From Sunday Miscellany. DeepSeek, the new tech name we all know this week. It's a Chinese AI tool and it did some serious damage to shares in US tech companies. On Drive Time, Davies Head of Equities, Aidan Donnelly, assessed the damage.
Yeah, well, I suppose everybody is focused on, in particular, the impact it's had on Nvidia's market capitalization yesterday. It wiped, believe it or not, $589 billion off the market cap of that company. But it's spread beyond technology as well into a lot of industrial companies and utility companies and a few other companies that are involved in the whole area of data centers and the proliferation of data centers going forward. But I think the big key question, I suppose, here for the market has been, you know, if you look back over the last kind of two and a bit years since ChatGPT was launched in November 2022, there's kind of been two fundamental assumptions that have been going on. One is, you know, if companies want to compete in AI or to use it, they're going to have to make massive and very energy intensive expenditure to do so. And then secondly, people thought that, you know, NVIDIA's lead in producing the chips for AI was so great. They basically had a monopoly. And, you know, there was commentators going on to say, look, this monopoly is going to remain in place for, you know, until the end of this decade.
OK, so, and this turned those assumptions on their head, really, I suppose, is the shock.
A shock indeed. And it has been described as an AI Sputnik moment. Also with Cormac, Professor Barry O'Sullivan from UCC's School of Computer Science. So, will this new app be taking our jobs, coming for our kin?
So there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of excitement around the technology. And you know, first of all, Geoffrey Hinton's assertion that, you know, this technology could pose an existential threat just isn't true at all. You know, I think I've said to you before, we can't keep our phones charged, you know, so let's not lose the run of ourselves.
Well, certainly this technology... he says that if it has a reasoning capacity, which they say it does here, and if it can elaborate on its own terms, well, then it's not an existential threat.
No, so the reasoning capability that we're talking about here in the context of deep seek is just its ability to make sense of common logical statements, you know, so just to do mathematical reasoning, not to do the kind of reasoning that Geoffrey Hinton would have been speaking about last April, which is this ability to think in the same way as a human being. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge difference between these. And of course, the problem for the general public and, you know, people who, I suppose, don't understand the technology is that these terms all seem to be the same thing, but they're not really.
But is there not a danger of the exponential power of the machine to elaborate on its own reasoning, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is if you look at these large language models, they have essentially consumed everything that they can consume. There isn't an exponential amount of information that they haven't consumed yet. So they have essentially been trained on all the data that they possibly could ever be trained on. And so we already see that these things just make simple, common mistakes. The thing that's interesting here is that the Chinese companies were able to do this so cheaply. But of course, you can do things cheaply if you stand on if you use what's called open source code and open source models. You know, basically, you know, a company innovates and does something, and then they give you or make available their code so you can build upon it. We've actually done that ourselves. We've built, you know, large language models from open source data, and we can do it very, very efficiently. So, of course, everybody can do that.
But if he did have concerns, it was around data protection. The old click accept all, so tempting, but not always the wisest.
You know, the real story here is that this is a Chinese system, and if you look at the privacy aspects of it, the data that you're consenting to has been sent to China. The access to information on your phone has been sent to China. And we have to remember that the US and the Chinese see AI differently to the rest of the world. They see it through two lenses. They see it through the lens of finance, and they see it through the lens of national security. So I think people who choose now to download and install DeepSeek, I would really caution them to be very, very careful about what they consent to and to really understand that, because the timing of the release of the system is not a surprise either, you know, given what's happening in the United States. So there's a geopolitical aspect to this. Well, with TikTok, but also with Trump's withdrawing, for example, the support for ethical AI.
Okay.
From Drive Time, may we live in interesting times. And coming back around again, Dr. Strangelove, the 1964 Kubrick film has been written for the stage by Armando Iannucci and stars Steve Coogan. Now, the film's full title is Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. So this was a good place to start.
Did you drink up the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis or anything like that? Because that's kind of where Stanley Kubrick was, and that's where his head was when he came up with this.
That's where he was. And there was a serious version that he wrote of the film. Very, very dramatic. But the more he explored it, and it was all about mutually assured destruction, or MAD, as it was officially called, MAD, that, you know, if... nothing will happen because if we've got weapons, they've got weapons. They know if they fire their weapons, we'll fire ours and everyone will die. So that's not going to happen. MAD. And the more he explored it, the more he realised it had to be done as a comedy because it was just so absurd. So we've taken that a little bit further.
And they got into political satire. He is, after all, the writer behind The Thick of It and Veep.
From The Thick of It, we got a word in it was the Oxford English Dictionary's Word of the Year, which was omnishambles.
Amazing word.
It was at that point I thought I'd better stop the show now because, yeah, you know, it was people were quoting it in Parliament and stuff.
That's right.
And these days he hosts a podcast, A Strong Message Here, taking a deep dive into spin and all kinds of verbal tomfoolery. As you might imagine, Oliver...
One that's emerging is miserabilism.
Oh, right.
It's hard to say early in the morning. Miserabilism, which is that thing of talking down prospects, saying the economy's terrible.
Oh, yes.
We inherited a mess.
Okay, yeah.
Nothing is working. It's all broken.
We've been here with shoulders to the wheel and pull on the green jersey.
Green jersey, high-vis jacket and shovels on the ground was what our Chancellor was announcing yesterday. Shovels on the ground.
It makes it sound like they're doing it.
I know. It sounds very active and energetic, pulling the levers of growth, as if somehow there's a button in her under her desk that says growth, you know.
We had someone promising to be transparent with the Irish people at one stage and was frankly saying, Paddy likes to know what the story is.
Oh, dear. that begs so many questions, yes.
And leave it to Oliver to introduce a few Irishisms.
Is stroke politics a thing they use in England?
No, I think that would get you arrested. What's stroke politics?
It's a tradition, you know, where you have TDs and ministers, TDs being our MPs and ministers, who kind of pull off a coup for their own very small parish to do something to further their careers. And the opposition goes, stroke politics.
Stroke? Now, where's the origin of stroke then?
What's stroke would be kind of pulling a stroke. You a little
So that's pork barrel in America, isn't it? Pork barrel.
Yes,
politics,
yes.
When you get funds for a bridge to be built in your district, even though there's no water or railway lines for it to go over.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Or generally your Henry Kissinger episode, which is about, you know, apologies that aren't apologies. Mistakes were made.
Mistakes, that's right. It's the art of giving the passive apology so that it doesn't sound like you. Sounds like you're apologising, but when you look at the language, you're not apologising. You're saying, you know, instead of saying, I'm sorry if I offended you, I'm sorry if you were offended. That was never the intention.
Yes, it's very conditional.
Yes, exactly.
If you happen to be offended.
And almost like it's your fault for being offended by something.
And then the listeners got involved.
Someone says, my most disliked bit of political speak is, let me be very clear.
Let me be very clear here. The contextualisation of the infrastructure project will not be undermined by the overriding prospects of a downplay in economic growth. And I'm very clear about that.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
I understand everything. The next politician that tells us we're an island nation should be instantly dismissed. I learned this fact in national school, but it is a catch-all term. It's almost that we can't do anything. Well, we're an island nation.
Constant. Tony Blair, when he was Prime Minister, at one point said we are a young country.
Right.
No, we're really not.
A thousand we years of uninterrupted.
That. So I don't know what that was about.
And then finally this, not quite spin, but definitely worth repeating.
Some minister in Scotland, when the Pope was talking about politics, and some minister in Scotland said, I wish this Pope would stop pontificating. I thought, well, if he's allowed to do one thing, it really is that.
Armando Iannucci with Oliver. Now, we are almost at a finish, but even here on Team Playback, we know there's some class a big game later. Come for the rugby, stay for the tunes.
So that is DJ's Mark McCabe, Maniac 2000 there. And Aoife, is that the sort of tune that you're thinking of playing?
Well, I'm not sure if that's exactly made the playlist yet, Sarah, but we'll wait and see on Saturday.
Aoife Clark of the IRFU, ever the diplomat.
So is that part of the strategy here, that you'll be playing lots of different songs? And how will you decide on the songs? And how do you hope that will help?
Yeah, I suppose we've been working with Mark directly to sort of, you know, what kind of songs work and you know, at different points in the game, you know, when there's kind of natural lulls in play, I suppose. So, look, it's something we're going to test. It's feedback that we got through the survey that we did after our games in November. So we had a great response to that. You know, we had over 11,000 responses and, you know, we asked people to give us examples, I suppose, of things that would help improve the atmosphere, and music between play or at breaks and play was one of those suggestions. So that's why we're going to give it a go this weekend.
Oh, looking for suggestions, are we? Happy to help. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. Yeah, dance.
Dig. Chills that you spill up my back. of what's to come.